If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch this Thursday afternoon. Coming up a little bit later, Suzanne Muchin will be along, you know, from The Big Payoff. That is the podcast you can listen to on WGNplus.com. They talk about women's issues in the workplace. Ian Schur from CNET. And we are going to talk to Ian about the idea that the porn industry is now leading the way in virtual reality, as they have in so many other, you know, it's because of, in many ways, the porn industry that cable took off, that video streaming was accelerated because of all the guys who actually video stores, too. So now they've moved into virtual reality, and it might be our dirty little secret, but it's the truth, and we'll kick that around a little bit later today. Right now, Dennis Rodkin is here from Crane Chicago Business to talk about the pornography industry in Chicago.
The real estate porn, I'm a master of that.
That is pornographic sometimes.
It's true.
Hey, I want to start, though, with a story that's coming out of New York and I think Miami, where the feds are looking at condo sales, condos as a vehicle for money laundering. Can you explain that to me?
By foreign buyers primarily. Yeah, they're gonna pay closer attention to secret or well-veiled purchases because they're concerned that current money could be being laundered through American real estate.
I know that was a big deal in London. I think with a lot of the Russian bosses and things would buy these palaces in London to hide their money.
And it appears that there's a belief it's happening in New York and Miami. The New York Times broke the story about this buying binge, these people buying these properties quite a while ago, and now the government is following up with cracking down. But one thing we ought to be clear about is it doesn't seem to be happening in Chicago, largely because we just don't have that influx of international money. We have international buyers. We don't have them in the volume that New York and Miami have. I was at a talk the other day that repeated what we've been hearing for years, which is that Chicago, though it's the second largest city, is down in the 8, 9, 10 rankings for international buyers.
Is that because of its location?
It's because of its location. It's because of its weather. Yeah. But one reason that international buyers would come here is a lot of the buying happens near where your children are going to go to college. And we have great universities. And when you look at a lot of the international buying that happens here, that is quite a bit of what happens.
All right. Let's talk housing in Chicago. The number of foreclosures at the end of last year was at its lowest level since the bust, right?
Since 2007, yeah. Or the total foreclosure activity during the course of 2015 in the Chicago area was lower than it had been any year since 2007. And although the housing, 2008, although the housing bust actually started earlier, the foreclosure problem followed a little bit later because I had to fall into default and be pursued by my bank, and that might have taken a year or even longer. So this is the lowest it's been. Foreclosure activity in 2015 was less than half. It was about 43% of our peak year, 2010. So we seem to be finally start putting that in the rearview mirror.
We're still doing, I mean, when you look at the rest of the country, right, we're still leading around, you know, toward the top tier.
We are. We are still in that top tier, but it's shrinking. And there are several cities, I can't name them right now, where foreclosure activity went up in 2015. We continued down. So that's good news.
Well, there's another. Dennis writes in Cranes, and there are about 15 stories in the past week that you've written. So I want you to slow down a little bit. But one of them is the fact
I've got a lot of deadlines to meet, Steve.
There's not a lot of choice. There aren't a lot of houses on the market
right
this time. And maybe that will lead into the next story, because what's fascinating to me is this idea of boomers and millennials as bookends when it comes to buying houses. Boomers are the ones unloading. Millennials are the one moving into the time of their life when they would be buying the boomers' houses.
Well, part of the problem here is that boomers aren't unloading in the volume they could be. A lot of baby boomers aren't selling because they maybe can't retire as early as they thought they could, because all their retirement funds you know, wandered off. The house isn't worth as much as they thought it would be, so they can't sell it for the kind of proceeds they thought. They may even be underwater. And there are other reasons that people may not be, baby boomers may not be unloading a house as we'd like them to, while millennials are creating a lot of demand. One of the numbers in that story is that millennials took out 41% of the purchase mortgages, as opposed to refinancing mortgages, in the Chicago area in 2015. Nationally, only 35% of purchase mortgages were from millennials.
So they're buying here more than they are there.
Yeah, they're buying here more than in other cities, and that's largely because we're such an affordable city.
One of the agents that you quoted said that boomers often need a catapulting event to get them out of their house.
Yeah, grandkids in another city. Full retirement as opposed to partial retirement, or one of us in the house being retired and the other not. Really a time when you really can make an abrupt change, like move out and live by your grandkids in Texas.
Do millennials want to buy houses that boomers are moving out of?
This is the problem. They're not necessarily talking about a one-for-one connection. I'm 65 and I'll sell you my house and you're 30. But
that was only true, Dennis.
It was only true for a very short time that you were 30. And by the way, not yet 65. I have a few years to go.
I was going to ask off the air.
Yeah. But anyway, it's not a one-for-one swap. But, you know, as baby boomers sell their houses, then somebody might move up into that. It's a log rolling kind of effect. But one of the problems that this Realtor.com economist who spoke pointed out is that boomers are very often selling in places where millennials aren't buying. The baby boom generation tends to be suburban. The millennial generation tends to be urban.
We've got 30 seconds. Uh-huh. Will a millennial buy Richard Marx's house?
If they've got $16 million and it's got to come back on the market. It just went off the market earlier this month.
So he moved back to L.A. or moved to L.A.?
Remarried.
So the house that he raised his family up on, it's on the lake, right? Lake Michigan?
Yeah, it's got lake frontage. It originally had over 40 rooms, though they don't count it that way now. It's 24,000 square feet. I think a whole bunch of millennials might get together and buy it.
I don't think that would, I think that would violate some zoning rules.
It might.
Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
It's 12:23 on the Wintrust Business Lunch at 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for tuning in. Ian Schur is on a phone line as well. Ian joins us from time to time from CNET. And, you know, Ian, I want to talk about this article that CNET put up this past week about virtual reality. Everyone's talking about that. But the fact that it's being led in many ways by the porn industry. And if you look at the tech history and pornography, it only kind of makes sense, right? Because where pornography goes, the rest of the world sort of follows.
Oh, it really makes sense. So if you think about it, go back in time, you look at adoption of VHS, DVD, even mobile video. Porn is usually one of the first things to show up there and really take hold. I remember that when Apple came out with the iPod that had video in it in 2005, one of the first stories I saw was, oh, there's already porn for it. And so part of it is that we have to remember that pornography is a very large percentage of the internet. No one really keeps track of this thing very well, but the estimates are that it's a much larger number than you can ever imagine in percentage terms of how much internet kind of information there is. But also, when it comes to pornography, there's an expectation that it's going to grow significantly. So already, you know, they've started creating VR porn last year, actually. But by 2020, there's an analyst firm that says that it's going to be $1 billion a year business.
So the idea is you buy these goggles, right? And then you plug your phone into the goggles and use software through the phone. Is that kind of how this works?
Right. So the way virtual reality works in a very basic way is that it takes a screen of some sort, puts it in goggles, and straps it to your face. And as a result, when you're looking around, your brain is tricked, and it makes you think that you're almost there. And so you could be on a skyscraper, for example, shown one, and you can actually get vertigo. and or you could have a Tyrannosaurus Rex show up and walk over to you and start breathing on you, and people get scared, right? Virtual reality is a very interesting thing, and a lot of it is an exercise in telling us exactly how our brains work and how easily we are to trick. So when it comes to pornography, right, making you feel as though you're there is the key thing, and that's what a lot of these videos so far are doing. So when it comes to this, a lot of the VR porn right now that's accessible, we have a story on CNET where we actually have a photo of our reporter testing it out, making sure he's doing his journalistic work.
That's a brave man, I'll tell you.
And what he's doing is he's wearing the goggles and he's using a smartphone version of VR, right, where it pops into the goggles. There's also higher-end versions as well that are coming out this year that are even more expensive. The smartphone version made by Samsung costs $99 plus the phone.
I like that one of the companies, the porn company, says, yeah, we got games with it too and different museum sorts of pieces, because no one wants you to think they're actually using it for porn. So it goes back.
I mean, there's all sorts of stuff, right?
It's as far back as, you know, going behind the curtain at the video store to make your selection. I mean, it's just amazing. Okay, I want to move on because we don't have a lot of time today. But there's also an article. I recently got a new phone, an iPhone 6, and was presented with the idea of, well, you can wait till the fall or you can get one now and lease one month to month. That's what you're going to have to do in the fall anyway. When I heard that, I know that's the way every company's going, I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to get ripped off. But you guys have run some numbers that maybe it's not such a bad deal.
Yeah, so we broke down the numbers in one of our more recent stories on CNET. And what we found was that actually you may end up paying slightly less, and by slightly less, I mean a dollar, than you would have under a two-year contract plan for these new plans. And part of the reason is that for a lot of things, actually. So first off, when we started buying phones, really like decades ago, they were always hiding the price from us, right? When I would buy a phone from AT&T or Sprint or Verizon or T-Mobile, they would hand it to me either for free or they'd charge me $100 or $200. It didn't actually cost that. And so when I broke my phone and I walked over with my head hung low and I said, I need a new phone, they'd say, okay, well, $600. And I'm like, wait a minute, I just paid $200 the first time around.
Well, I like too that
the price.
And the people who, you know, paid $200 and then kept it beyond 2 years were really getting ripped off because they kept paying for that phone in hidden fees for months and months.
Exactly. And those fees were not actually made clear to you. So now they're basically doing that. They're making it clear to you how much it costs. You pay off the device, quote unquote, within 12, 18 or 24 months, and then you own it and you can bring it to another carrier and you can save all that money. So it's actually working out well in your favor now, even though it may feel like you're spending more.
We're so used to being ripped off, Ian, it doesn't feel right. Listen,
we like to see a lower number no matter what it is. That's what it comes down to, right? It's a very American thing.
Thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Ian Schur from CNET.com. It is 12:37. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Hey, here's Suzanne Muchen, co-host of The Big Payoff on WGNplus.com. Suzanne, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Steve. Do you have any muffins?
Do I have any muffins? Would you like a muffin?
I would, but I won't reach for one.
Was that
last
week?
Do you know we got a lot of backlash about that?
And the idea was,
people weren't happy that I had said that I had basically whittled down the whole, you know, how should women behave in meetings to whether or not they should give a man a muffin.
Because what you said, and you were relaying someone else's advice.
I was, yeah.
Don't
serve the muffins.
Don't go to a muffin because someone will ask you to give them a muffin.
Correct.
And immediately become subservient.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not into that one. I don't think Let's talk about this Harvard study about female economists and whether or not they get the credit that male economists do when they collaborate, right? Essentially, that's what we're talking about.
It's such a fascinating topic because if you go out into the world and you think about an economist, you think about a man in the same way they've done a study and asked girls, if you picture a scientist, who do you picture? Mm-hmm. And most of them were men in coats. It's a field where there are, in fact, a lot of women. But the question is, are they getting the credit for their work? And in a field like this, it's publish or perish, right? So they either have to write a paper and get credit for it so they can get tenure. And what this study found is that when they write alone, they get a lot of credit. When they write with men, they get a whole lot less.
How do they measure that, Suzanne?
By the connection between their papers and the number of papers they publish and how that connects to them getting tenure.
So there's a relationship that way.
A direct relationship.
Okay, I would say, well, that has to do with the fact that you're collaborating and that dilutes your influence because you're sharing the byline, which the evidence dictates is not true.
You'd think that would be true, except for the fact that when men collaborate with women, they get full credit.
So couldn't it also be that men just are more likely to get tenure than women unfairly? But I mean,
because they're smarter?
No, I'm saying unfairly.
Oh,
but I mean,
I think these are connected. That's a possible conclusion. But I think the real conversation here is if women in a field like this find themselves without the credit they deserve for the work they're doing, does that teach them to go it alone? Or should they fight back harder to try to get the credit they deserve?
I think they should continue to do the job the best they can and fight for recognition after doing that.
Rather than just saying, you know what, rather screw
than saying,
it,
you know,
I'm just going to go on my own.
Fritz, I could do a better paper with you, but I'm not going to because it might not lead to me getting tenure. Yeah, I don't think they should do that.
You know, we agree on this, Steve.
Nice.
We agree on this. I couldn't agree more. It's an opportunity for women to continuously stand up, just like Jennifer Lawrence did when she talked about in the movie Birdman how she wasn't getting equal pay, right? It's an opportunity to stand. Was it Birdman? I just said that. It might not have been the movie.
She wasn't in Birdman.
She wasn't in Birdman,
she flew out of that one, yeah.
Recent movie. She's saying, you know what? It's not up to me to just boo-hoo-hoo on the sidelines. I have to raise the awareness about it and then fight for it.
Okay, I want to move on, but what do you say then to Kate Winslet, who got beat up for saying, oh, that's vulgar. I'm not going to say that. You know, I'm not going to have that public discussion. And I think it's a British
I think that's
sentiment,
cultural.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's cultural.
But what she's saying is like, look, we make millions and millions of dollars. People aren't going to want to hear us whine about not making as much as someone else.
That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is that's not really the point.
And everyone
made.
Is looking at Jennifer Lawrence.
They are, deservedly so.
Right. So, I mean, if she makes the point,
yes.
It's going to be heard.
Right.
Okay, there's this movement in, I want to say starts in Scandinavia. But,
always. These kind of movements always do. It's always a good bet.
Where if you're an adult, what country are we talking about? Sweden? Finland?
Finland.
Okay, so you're an adult in Finland and essentially you get paid $1,000 a month.
You do.
By the government.
By
the
government.
You just get paid.
It's called universal basic income. And when I read about this, my first thought was, right, of course it's in Finland. It's in some, you know, country in Europe that's much more kumbaya than the United States. But then I dug a little deeper and found there is a huge movement, and women are a big part of it, to get universal basic income. Here's another fun fact. In 1970, Richard Nixon actually proposed this. It was called back then the Guaranteed Annual Income, and the House passed a bill. So it's not that crazy.
Okay. Well, so right now they're considering it in Switzerland, right?
Yes.
And they're considering it in other spots.
Right.
So it is growing.
It's a big movement.
It has escaped Scandinavia.
It has. And what's interesting is women are behind this, although not necessarily from a feminist perspective. But they are saying we are caregivers and aren't getting paid for that.
When Richard Nixon suggested it, would Richard Nixon have gotten a check too, or was it need-based?
That's an excellent question. No, everybody, that's the whole point of this. Everyone across the board gets in this case for the U.S. would be about $1,000 a month.
What do you think?
I think it's a great idea.
You do?
I think it's a great idea. The market forces would still be in play. It's not like this is communism.
If they did it, if they're going to give you a check, I'm assuming they're going to take other checks away.
No, this is about having a guaranteed basic level of income.
Okay, but
it's not a substitute for other checks. It's a substitute for a system like welfare.
Well, that's what I mean then. So if it's a substitute for food stamps or things like that, would they take the food stamps away?
I don't think they'd take food stamps away. There's a whole economic model that allows for this to actually occur that says it would not only be better for our society as a whole, but it would be better for the marketplace. This would improve capitalism.
How would it improve capitalism?
Because so this is the great little snippet that this is how I understood it well. If a bread...
All right, we're about to break into The Big Short here. Susan,
exactly. Selena Gomez on Universal Basic Income, right, in The Voice of Suzanne Muchin. So this is the very basic, as I understood it. If a bread maker is making bread for 70% of the population, but in fact 80% of the population really want it, but there's 10% that can't afford it, that's a lose-lose. This would solve for that.
So this would give that last 10% enough money to afford the bread.
And the bread makers win. Everybody wins.
Deficit spending, right?
Could be.
Could be. but another appeal of this is that it's not You said it's being led by women, or there's a force of women behind it. But it's not a left-right thing, right? There
no.
are people on the right who like this idea, too.
That's what I loved about it. I mean, there were people from the American Enterprise Institute and people from the unions saying this is a good idea. So I love the fact that it's a real conversation. In fact, I think another radio station today that shall not be mentioned was doing a whole hour on it.
Really?
Yep.
Well, we just did all they need
scoop
to know
them.
In 4 minutes.
Totally scooped them.
We've just got a minute or two left, but as I said before, you're the co-host of The Big Payoff at WGNplus.com. And you pointed out that Angela Merkel was the Time Magazine Person of the Year today, this year.
Yes.
And it's been, what, 4 or 5 years since that?
Steve,
since the
I wish
woman.
You all could see the twinkle in his eye when he just said that to me, because he knows the fact.
The last woman of the year,
yeah.
back when it was only a man of the year, was Corazon Aquino.
Yeah.
29 years ago. So you've got an interview with the Time Magazine person,
We
right?
did. So we did a podcast interview yesterday with the deputy editor of Time, who oversees that whole process of selecting Woman of the Year. And I have to say, it was a fascinating conversation to pull back the curtain. But that fact alone, that it's been 29 years, and it was only 1999 that they even changed it to be Person of the Year rather than Man of the Year.
Wasn't
Come on.
Benji, was Benji Dog of the Year once? What didn't even
no.
Benji win?
No? No, Benji was not. No, but she pointed out something interesting, which is this isn't actually like a wonderful prize. I mean, Adolf Hitler, Ayatollah Khomeini, Stalin. I mean, this is about newsmakers.
So maybe they were doing it for women, not naming them for 29 years.
I'm positive that wasn't the case.
Suzanne Muchin, The Big Payoff at WGNplus.com. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Well, 52 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I'm Steve Bertrand. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand or on Facebook at Steve Bertrand on Books or at Steve Bertrand or at Steve Bertrand Travel, or you can take your pick. Elise Glink is on a phone line. She's a frequent contributor to the program. Thanks very much for joining us, Elise.
Hey, it's nice to be here, Steve.
All right. So we talked last time you were here about your podcast, Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Glink and John Byrne, that is now available in WGN+. So I want to make sure people check that out. I want to ask you, though, about I saw your newsletter where you're working on this app. Now, here's what I'm concerned about. And we talked about this last time. You know, you're always trying to keep up with technology and all. And I think I do fairly well. I'm going to have a hard time giving up my laptop and working just on my mobile device, but I'm going to have to eventually do that, am I not?
I think that most of us are going to do most things on our phones, and then there are going to be some things that we don't do on our phones, right? I can't imagine kids doing homework on their phones, although they're really, yeah. you know, throughout the country using iPads now for that. So it's not quite a laptop, but it's also not quite a phone.
Maybe
so
that's it.
There will be things to do.
It'll be in between. I mean, I've got the iPhone 6 Gigante or whatever, so it's a little bigger than
of your head, right?
But speaking of developing for mobility and all that, you write that you're working on this Best Money Moves app that would be for employers, correct? Actually, employers would get it for their employees.
Yeah, that's right. It's, you know, the idea here is that, and we see all kinds of news, it's January, and so all the personal finance news is coming out, and we've seen news studies that 63% of people have less than $500 in savings. We see that college students are graduating with $20,000 in credit card debt and $50,000 of student loans. We see that that is causing millennials, all that debt, to not buy homes and push the average age of a first-time home buyer from 29 to 34. So when you look at the cost of debt in society and to people, and you realize as an employer that when your people are very, you know, have debt and don't know how they're going to make ends meet by the end of the month, they're very distracted. As an employer, you want to do something. So we started to talk to employers last year, and they asked us to find a solution that would help their employees be more focused on it, and that's what we're building right now.
Is it kind of like a Fitbit for your wallet?
No. I don't know. We hadn't thought about putting on jewelry with it or a wristband.
Yeah, but it is something you carry around all the time. And
it's in your phone. This is really going to be a mobile-first app because the people that we're designing it for who are earning between, say, $30,000 and $85,000 a year, most of them have their phones. They don't sit at desks like you and I do and have desktops. They're out there in factories or they're on the floor. They're in their cars. They're salespeople or they're pulling cappuccinos at Starbucks. you know, these are people who have jobs that are sort of the middle America that we keep hearing about. I want to help middle America make smarter decisions with their money.
And so you're working on a beta version now, right? Are you enlisting help, or you have the companies you need to help you?
We are looking for companies. If companies would like to join us, they should email me at thinklink.com or follow on Twitter at Glink.
And so what would be required of these companies? What would they be involved in?
Oh, you know, just a little bit of this and that. We are having some very interesting conversations with companies who want to be a part of the pilot program right now, which we're hoping to actually get up and running a little bit later this year. And we're looking for companies that are concerned about how their employees spend the money that they make.
A little bit.
You know what?
Yeah.
They need them to do the best they can with it.
A little bit of this and a little bit of that. You sound like a chef in the kitchen who doesn't want to spill the beans.
That's what I'm doing. I'm cooking up something fun.
Nice to talk to you, Elise.
Thanks, Steve.
We'll take a break. Bill and Wendy, just around the corner here. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch.